Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
If instead Putin doubles down, then so shall we, further ratcheting up economic pressure and supporting Ukraine with finance.
Sanctions have to be as powerful as they can possibly be. We will be pushing the government to go further and faster.
We could have a massive miscalculation and we will then be in a full-scale war across the globe.
You're listening to Bloomberg Westminster, your daily guide to British politics. I'm Ewan Potts.
And good afternoon, I'm Caroline Hepker. Coming up on today's programme, we're joined by the new chair of the London Assembly, plus Professor Samuel Green, the director of the Russia Institute at King's College London, will be joining us for the latest on Ukraine.
So the government says it will bring urgency, impatience and determination to deliver on its mission of getting our country back on track and easing the burdens on families and businesses. Boris Johnson's administration is setting out its legislative agenda today for the next parliamentary session in its Queen's speech.
But it is a Queen's speech with a difference because it will be delivered by Prince Charles, with the Queen suffering from ongoing mobility issues. Now, in all, 38 parliamentary bills are due to be unveiled with the focus on boosting economic growth.
Well, measures will include education reforms to raise standards in schools and a new drive to build nuclear power stations and to expand offshore wind power. But the government is reported to have dropped plans for a bill which would have created a single agency to enforce employee rights.
OK, so that's the Queen's speech. Meanwhile, Boris Johnson's Conservatives, of course, lost three London strongholds in last week's local election. That is in Barnet, in Wandsworth and Westminster. Sophologists will be trying to explain exactly why, no doubt for days. But one reason could be the narrow post-Brexit nationalism, as it's perceived by some, of the Tory government.
One newspaper quoted Conservative leader of Barnet Council, Daniel Thomas, saying that the loss of Barnet Council was a warning shot from Conservative voters. Well, joining us now is Labour's Dr. Ankur Sahota, who took over as chair of the London Assembly this week. Ankur, thanks so much for joining us on Bloomberg Westminster today. Now, the Queen's speech says it aims to grow the economy and ease the burden of rising costs and to level up the UK. Do you worry that London risks missing out as the government focuses on the Midlands and the North?
Good morning. I think I'll answer the question as a Labour member for Ealing and Lincoln. And of course, I think the opportunity has been lost. When I was on the doorstep, people were concerned about the cost of living, and they were concerned about how the Prime Minister's own views on the party gate. And I think that the cost of living crisis is a real concern for Londoners. And levelling up doesn't mean levelling London down. It means that we bring up the rest of the country to the standards of London and let London grow too. So I think the policy of the government about levelling up is geographical-based rather than needs-based. There are pockets of London which have high levels of deprivation, communities who are quite deprived, and London has got one of the best left-wing communities also, but we also have a huge burden of inequality in London too. And you can't just say London's doing all right, and you'd be ignoring all those vulnerable communities in London too.
Okay. In 2018, the Conservatives held 7 London councils out of 32. They certainly don't have even that now. Why, on the flip side, do you think that what are seen and are affluent areas, I mean, London is the wealthiest part of the whole country, why do you think that even affluent areas turned to Labour in London?
I think that this was because people were very concerned about it, as I say, about the cost of living, but they were also concerned about the party gate. I was hearing that this is a real issue, the fact that the Prime Minister had lost its moral standing. And I think the public wanted to give a message to the government that you can't make one rule for all of us and live by different rules yourself. And I think this is a vote ride where people wanted a real change, they wanted real opportunities for their communities. And that's why we see Wandsworth, Westminster and Barnet being gained by Labour, which they haven't had previously for many, many years.
Now, the Ulez low emission zone is expanding soon. Do you have any sympathy for people who live in outer London on modest incomes who may not be able to afford an expensive new car?
I have a lot of sympathy for people who can't afford the change, and I hope that the government will help London in delivering a scrappy scheme. But I also do know, and I say this particularly as a background as a medical doctor, that people can't afford to inhale bad quality air. We know that there are disproportionate amounts of deaths due to poor air quality in London. We also know that children's lungs are getting stunted because of poor air quality. And we know that where we have introduced ULEZ, there has been improvement in the health of people, and that we know that there are people's lives improved. So I understand the dilemma, but none of us can afford to inhale bad quality air. And I think the mayor is right to pursue this policy. But I think the government needs to help London deliver on the needs of Londoners too.
Yes, but it's been years that we've had attempts to bring down the amount of motoring and therefore control air quality in London, and nothing really has worked. I mean, air quality in London is still incredibly poor. The tracking of London air quality is also perhaps an issue. Why has this been so difficult to tackle for London, as you say, when it is clearly one of the most pressing health issues for the capital?
I think that the previous tattoos becoming the mayor of London, this wasn't being taken seriously. And do you know that none of the areas in London meet the WHO guidelines for healthy air, right? And none of them reach the guidelines for the nitrogen oxide, which have been handled with World Health Organization.
And have not done so for years. So this is.
And have not done so for years. So here we have a mayor, right, who is now, he himself has suffered from asthma. He knows what the impact is. And we've had, for the first time, a child dying in London whose cause of death, right, was caused as poor air quality. So there's an emergency taking place in London. And here we have a mayor who was serious about attacking this problem. Just because it hasn't been done for many, many years before, it doesn't mean that we don't do it now.
But the mayor has been in office since 2016. No, I'm not criticising that we shouldn't act on it. But, you know, you can seriously wonder why, since 2016, the impact has not been felt more. I mean, especially because we had lockdown for months in London, and that was something that had an impact on air quality.
Yes, and I'm saying that the evidence has shown that the number of hospital admissions for respiratory diseases has been reduced by 30% over this time. But we are making improvements. We are making roadways into this. And so I think this is the right policy. But it is incremental. You can't just do it overnight. We are making right steps and we're taking bold decisions for the future.
Sadiq Khan's precept for the council taxes has increased by 9% this year, meaning that the average London household will now pay him £400 a year. Over the course of this Labour morality, council tax has risen much, much quicker, hasn't it, than when the Conservatives ran the morality under Boris Johnson. Are you happy that the council tax is increasing whilst cost of living is soaring for many Londoners?
Well, I'm not happy about council tax being up, and let's be clear that the council tax is regressive and that we should be looking at much more fairer ways of raising money to support local communities. I understand raising the council tax has put pressure on the poorest communities and is never ideal. But on the other hand, we are faced right with a government right which has been reducing the fundings being given to local authorities. The need for social services has gone up in the communities. We need to make sure that we have enough police officers on the road, that we have enough police services, fire services on the road, and that we need to make sure that we are protecting the community. So somehow we have to raise that money, and that's why I come to the argument I did beforehand, that levelling up, again, there shouldn't be just geographical, right? It should be needs-based. And I think London needs the help of the government also in making sure that we get our fair share of the growth funds which are available. But I agree entirely that the raising council tax is a regressive tax, and we need to find much more fair ways of raising money for Londoners.
You mentioned policing. I want to ask you about the policing strategy. This is of major concern. Are police numbers in London going up swiftly enough? There's a great concern around the loss of faith that there's been in policing by the Metropolitan Police.
I think, of course, the police numbers have gone up and been the highest since Boris Johnson left City Hall since 2016. But we need more police numbers, and of course the fair share which London should be getting increased on is about 6,000 police officers now. We haven't been promised that. But I think on top of that, it's not just about increasing police numbers, right? It's also about creating the atmosphere that the London that we attack the causes of crime also. That means that our centres have closed down, that we've had the deprivation increasing, people feeling difficulty meeting the ends meet. So this all breeds crime. So we not only should be strong on crime and criminals, right, but we should also be strong on the causes of crime. And I think that's why this mayor is making a lot of investment on a public health approach to crime, and we need to be addressing those root causes also.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare.
Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's have a look at what else is making news in the world of politics. Joining us for that today is Bloomberg's Leanne Gerrans. Leanne, hello. So Keir Starmer leads many of the newspapers this morning, this pledge to resign if he's fired for what the newspapers call Beergate. I mean, it's leading to a lot of speculation, though, about who's actually going to succeed him. Is that really smart?
I think that he is going on the lines that he is the opposition Labour leader, as we know, but he's also been named Mr. Rules. We did know that Keir Starmer isolated six times during the coronavirus pandemic, more than any other politician, because he is adamant that he sticks to the rules. And this is one of the main things that has always been part of Keir Starmer's makeup, if you like, within Parliament. So yesterday, he did a press conference, and it was quite revealing. He said, if I am found to have been broken the rules after this police investigation happens, I will step down because that is the right thing to do. He's saying, I believe in honour, integrity and the principle that those who make the laws must follow them. So speculation about who might follow him is an interesting one because behind the scenes, Labour, Caroline and Ewan are very, very confident that they didn't break any laws. And this is something Keir Starmer said time and time again yesterday. But then we also heard that his deputy, Angela Rayner, also says she'll step down if she is found to have broken these rules. So we might have a vacuum at the top of Labour. But the other thing that people are asking are now Labour putting pressure on the police to clear them because they've both saying that they're going to resign. But of course, they're also putting pressure on Boris Johnson, who was fined and didn't resign.
Yeah, quite a dramatic move yesterday when I saw that on my phone. I was, gosh, goodness, I think you messaged me, actually.
I did message you about it because I was watching the news and I really wasn't expecting to see that. But that is where Labour are standing firm at the moment.
Yeah, quite something. And on the economic front, retail sales have been pretty robust for at the start of this year, consumers having some of those lockdown savings to spend. But it does look like the tide may have turned.
A little bit, yeah. So you are right. I think there was a lot of pent-up demand, but UK retail sales are now falling. And this is really for the first time since January 2021. So you're right there, Ewan, as the cost of living crisis really begins to crush consumer confidence and does put the brake on spending. So the warning came in a closely watched survey by the British Retail Consortium, which said more pain is inevitable with stores having to raise prices further. Now, this is really in an attempt to shield their profit margins. The 0.3 decline in April from a year earlier, as I did mention, it's the first drop in over a year. And that was when the nation was in lockdown. I don't know if you can remember back to 2021 when we couldn't really spend that much money. Well, we could go to the supermarkets or online, but all the other rest of the high street shops were closed. And the figures really once again highlight the toll being taken by the squeeze on household budgets. You know, and also we should just cast our minds back to last week when the BOE said it expects inflation to top 10% later this year in about October. And I think this is the highest since the 1980s. And they're also warning of a risk of recession. And I do feel like households are now tightening their belts where they can as they see how their prices rise and re-look at their budgets, really, Caroline, which I know you've had a look at your spreadsheets, have I? as have I, you know, I've gone through all my...
I don't think I know anybody who hasn't thought about it, given that, you know, prices are rising so rapidly. Yeah, so that 0.3% drop in retail sales. I mean, I think it's also interesting because those BRC figures that you mentioned, you know, the BRC tracks the amount of cash, the amount of money that people are spending on retail sales. It's not sort of a tally of how much in volume people are buying. It's actually cash going into stores. So I think that's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, no, and I absolutely agree with you. But what's also interesting is most retail categories saw sales decline. So furniture, electrical goods and home accessories were hit the hardest. Okay. Now, remember, we were all buying those in lockdown as we didn't know what else to do but DIY. So maybe people are now going out to buy other things like clothes because we can't just walk around in gym kit anymore.
Leanne Gerrans, thanks so much for that update with some of today's political stories.
Okay, let's talk about matters more serious then, or other matters in terms of continental Europe. Ukrainian officials say that the port city of Odessa has been repeatedly bombed and the bodies of 44 people have been found in the rubble of a building which was destroyed in Kharkiv. It comes a day after Russia held a much-hyped military parade to commemorate the end of World War II. Now, there was a lot of Western speculation, media speculation, that Putin would use the moment to mark a dramatic new stage in his two-month war. But that really didn't materialise. Joining us now is Samuel Green, professor in Russian politics and the director of the Russian Institute at King's College London. Professor, welcome to the programme. Thanks for being with us. Now, first of all, what is your view on what happened at the parade in Red Square? We did watch Putin's speech. It was quite brief. It didn't mention Ukraine by name. Why do you think that was?
Well, I think he decided to sort of tread the path of least resistance, really. I mean, I think, you know, he would have had an opportunity if he wanted to declare a kind of victory. And he would have had an opportunity if he wanted to declare a broader war. But I think that he decided he wanted to leave himself sort of some rhetorical room for maneuver, right, to be able to make a decision down the road in terms of how long he wants to prosecute this war. Clearly, look, I mean, it was a belligerent speech. He's laying claims to significant portions of Ukrainian territory. It's a step back, I suppose, from, you know, laying claim to the entirety of Ukraine, as he did essentially when he announced the war. He's clearly not done fighting, and yet he's not willing to tell the Russian people that they will have to continue to make very significant economic sacrifices and sacrifices in terms of the lives of their sons and husbands, moral sacrifices in terms of the cost of this war to Ukraine, right, for the indefinite future.
Yeah, well, I wanted to ask you about how long this war is going to continue. The consensus seems to be that it's going to grind on slowly and painfully. Is that your view too?
It is at the moment. It's hard not to come to that conclusion. They seem to be looking to cement control over, you know, significant parts of eastern and southern Ukraine, possibly cutting Ukraine off more or less from the Black Sea entirely. That will not be an easy thing to do. That still requires taking large cities, including Odessa, which you just mentioned. And it's not entirely clear that they have the wherewithal to do that. Certainly Ukraine has the wherewithal to defend it. And so, without the ability to move quickly, without the ability to make those sorts of gains, Russia does seem to be looking towards making this a war of attrition, assuming that that Ukraine at some point will possibly be worn down. But more importantly, I think from their perspective, that that the West may eventually, you know, lose patience and commitment.
President Joe Biden is worried, has said out loud that he's concerned that the Russian president doesn't have a way out right now of the war. This is the UK government has pledged an extra £1.3 billion in military support. What then is this sort of next move? It's continued pressure, continued money to support Ukraine in the fighting on the ground.
Well, that is a big part of it, right? And Ukraine obviously, you know, is fighting alone, right? But it is fighting with the support of Western governments, and it is fighting with Western, you know, governments doing as much as they can, or as much as they feel they're able to do, to help Russia lose this war. The question is, what does it mean for Russia to lose the war, right? Does it mean, going back to the status quo on the 23rd of February when they controlled only much smaller parts of Ukraine? Does it mean going back to the status quo before 2014 when they controlled none of Ukraine? That's a question really only Kyiv can answer, except that, you know, to a certain extent, obviously Putin has to make a decision about what kind of a resolution he can live with. I think what we're heading towards most likely is some kind of a ceasefire, not quite a peace agreement, right, but eventually a ceasefire in which, neither side gets anything like what they want, right? So Russia ends up controlling a significant portion of Ukrainian territory, but not a lot of the things that it was aiming for. And Ukraine is left not fully able to regain sovereignty.
How important is a continued ramp up of the energy embargo? The EU's struggling to get this agreed, with Hungary holding out on this issue. But G7 countries say they're going to stop importing oil. Gas is altogether more difficult. But how important is cutting this off? It's not going to stop the war, is it?
Well, not in the short term. I mean, look, they do still have significant reserves, and even if they don't, you know, they're burning through them at quite a clip. But no, they can continue to fight this war. And look, this war, you know, I still don't have a great understanding. I think none of us do have a great understanding of what Putin ever thought he was going to benefit, what he was going to get from this war. But the reality is, it's not being, you know, fought on a sort of rational cost benefit analysis, right? So he will probably continue to fight, even if he feels like he's taking significant economic losses. But those losses will, you know, sap the ability of the Russian war machine to keep going, to purchase and build new equipment, to recruit new soldiers, and to continue to feed the population at the same time that it's fighting this war. You know, already the sanctions are hitting. They're not hitting as hard now as they will, I think, towards the second or third quarter of this year, but they will continue to bite. Energy sanctions will only multiply.
Bloomberg Westminster. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
The Bloomberg Sustainable Business Summit returns to London on April 25th for a solutions-driven look at the sustainable business and finance landscape, looking at the latest trends in ESG regulations, supply chain innovation and transition finance. Speakers include leaders from CDP, Emirates Environment Group, Seedtrace, COA and more. Summit advisors include City Commercial Bank, Red Sea Global and Schneider Electric. Visit bloomberglive.com/SBS2024 to learn more.